every once in a while, I'm watching something and it just catches my eye. It's visually arresting in a way that's unique, and I can't quite put my finger on it. And that's what happened when I was watching The United States versus Billie Holiday. Our guest today, Andrew Dunn, was the cinematographer behind that project. And Andrew has shot a ton of great movies. He's worked with Lee Daniels, who directed United States versus Billie Holiday, multiple times. He's worked with Robert Altman. He's worked with Whitney Houston. He's worked with all kinds of screen legends, filmmakers, stars. And he has insights that are worth hearing, to say the least. But one of the things that's so cool about United States versus Billie Holiday is that it was shot on film, actual film, which isn't super common anymore. And the more we talked about it, the more I realized, oh, that's what it was that caught my eye. Now, I'm not one of those people who's film over digital no matter what, and neither is Andrew, and we talk about that a little bit. But it's nice to have a guest on who used celluloid to tell their story. And it's nice to talk about why and how it impacts things. And we talk about everything from camera usage, even got a Bolex involved in there, to capturing moments like Whitney Houston singing in The Bodyguard. Andrew's career has taken a lot of twists and turns, but for me personally, there's just something about film and movies shot on it that holds a special place and has that unique look. So definitely check out the movie. But listen to the interview. Find out more about where Andrew comes from and how he approaches things and what makes this job worth doing to him.
So one of the first things I like to ask is, what began your interest in cinematography and in a career in film and filmmaking or television? Where did that start for you, like source of inspiration or initial discovery?
My initial interest in cinematography and taking photographs actually was very, very young, probably about 6 years old when I got my first film camera, 2¼ square, 120 film, and just going around taking photographs. And I could, of course, the expensive thing about the film and the getting processed and printed and everything, but it made me very careful about taking photographs and choosing them, selecting them. It must be around 8 or 9, I suppose. I just got this sort of inkling, and I don't, looking back, of course, time and memory are deceptive, but looking back, I think it's around 8 or 9, and I just had a real interest because we used to go see a lot of films as a family in London then. I was brought up in London, and you maybe go to a cinema 2-3 times a week, and I used to go on Saturday morning. I would do Saturday morning pictures with my brother.
What were the movies you saw then that had an impact? Do you remember?
At that age, it was more family films, and I can't.
Yeah.
I remember going to see. You probably never heard of Cliff Richard, but Cliff Richard was a British copy of Elvis, a cleaner version that your parents might like of Elvis Presley. The same hair. Same sort of wiggling the hips around and things.
Like the equivalent of his beach movies or those kinds of things?
Probably, yeah. They got a London omnibus and took it to Greece on a holiday or something. And then, of course, the Beatles, a lot of clever stuff going on in the 60s when I was a kid. As I got into my teenage years and saved some money, my hunger for movie film, I saved up and got an 8mm camera, which is what we call here standard 8, which is basically 60mm film cut down the middle. A bit like 60mm film is 35mm cut down the middle. And that was called standard 8. And I had my own primitive editing device with picture only, no sound at that point. And then from there, I got what you call a Super 8, which is actually a film that's made specifically for 8mm system rather than just 60mm split in the middle. Then I got a 16mm, testing my memory here, 16mm Clockwork Bolex.
Ah, I've seen those. I've used one of those.
8-16. In fact, tell you what, we actually used an 8-16 Bolex on Billie Holiday, but we'll come to that.
Oh, wow. What did you just tell me real quick, what did you shoot Billie Holiday on?
35mm film, anamorphic, C-series lenses, which are 50, 60 years old, and they have a certain sort of quality about them, which has, I think, what for me is an intimacy.
It's so funny. I don't consider myself a person who can tell every time I watch something what it was shot on anymore. Digital, even if it's digital film, I can often, like, after all the processing and everything, and when we see it streaming or wherever we see these things, but right from the first frames I saw, even in the trailers I saw for United States versus Billie Holiday, I was like, wait a second, something about this. Like, I, like, the look, like, grabbed me, and I was like, what is this? Like, why? It's a bit, is it the period? Because I'm a sucker for the period stuff. But now I know it's 35. Anyway.
That's so gratifying to hear, because, as I say, we just go through the process, because we do our DIs, it gets transferred to digital over the DI.
Of course.
And because it's never really out there, and people like Chris Nolan and some of those guys will actually make sure there's some prints to show in selected
scenes. Right, if you hunt it down, you can find some of those movies projected, but mostly you're going to see them on a digital format, ultimately.
The way the image moves is a certain life in celluloid, and I'm not being Luddite.
Yeah, it's a different medium. It has a different effect.
And also when I remember doing some tests for Crazy Stupid Love years ago, and those guys, two directors, John and Glenn, they were determined to shoot on digital at that point. It was still in its very early days, and we did some tests, and I did some panning shots. And when you pan on digital camera, it has a different capturing system than film, obviously. But one of the differences is it's a staccato move, and it's sort of the vertical lines, particularly jump, 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 jump. And the way film records is more like a human experience. But going back to my teenage years,
yes, your film discovery. We were talking about the Bolex.
And that's then where I jumped into the future. You know, whatever film I could get hold of. And then I got a 60mm Bewley, a French camera, with some nice lenses. I think I had two of these. And the second one, I think I've still got somewhere in a cupboard or an attic somewhere or other. And I made a bunch of films on that with my friends. And my brother, who's an actor, and his friends, we made a bunch of films. Actually, by then, I had a job in editing.
Working as an assistant?
Yeah, as an assistant. And also you got a chance to edit, which is great.
Cause yeah.
My boss in the editing department said to me, he knew I wanted to be a cameraman. And I just got into this editing thing because I'm quiet now, but then I was terribly quiet. And I just fell into it. I couldn't get a job on the camera side. So I went into editing. And my boss at that point, who knew I wanted to be a cameraman, said to me, "You'll never be a cameraman. You're too diffident," which means self-confident. if you see me now, my fist is like, because that's the best thing anyone ever, and some of your students listening to this, it's the best advice anyone ever gave to me, that you'll never do what you really want to do. And that made me more hungry, more determined to actually achieve what I wanted to achieve. And so this was now in my...
Wow. I was going to ask, did it crush you in some way? But it sounds like it did the exact opposite.
No, it did the exact opposite. Because he wanted me to stay in editing in his world. And I applying for his jobs in the camera side. Eventually, I got one as an assistant in BBC Scotland. Anyway, so I went to Scotland as a camera assistant. I moved up very, very quickly. And I was very lucky with my boss there, who was very encouraging, very avant-garde. We used to go to the cinema, again, in up there, a bit like a Tribeca Centre or somewhere like that in New York. The cinemas that show what then were quite interesting esoteric films.
And now we would have been more like, 70s, 80s at this
time?
Yeah,
it is now, I guess, late 70s or something.
What was coming there at the time? What were the things? One of the reasons I ask is because now everything that comes out is kind of like instantly available all over the place, or pretty quickly, depending on release schedules. But what a lot of people, especially listeners we have, might not recognize is that there was often a delay. So you might get something different than, a release that you would get there might have been a release that was timed differently, or might have been something local that we didn't see on the States for a while later.
Yes, so Glasgow Film, the London National Film Theatre, and they'd have it in various provincial places in the UK and of course, New York in the States. But they would even, like, during the week, they'd have different films each night. You have a program, so you go on a Friday night, whatever, you go on Saturday afternoon, you go see these films. But then I was lucky enough during this time to go to the Edinburgh Film Festival, Edinburgh Arts Festival, And amongst the film festival, so I would go there as a documentary cameraman and cover this festival and all the things going on, and I'd get into this world, and we'd go and see press showings of films because we could, and we're going to the premiere of Robbie Muller, Wim Wenders, I think it was American Friend or something like that, one of those films.
Oh, yeah.
Abel Gance, Napoleon. So this is a very formative time in my life, going to Scotland. And I didn't know what I was doing by going there. I just wanted to get out of the editing side and to actually get my hands on cameras and start making films as a cameraman rather than an editor. So having said that, as an editor, I could put my film I shoot at weekends, into the bath secretly, go through the lab. Exactly. With in England, I give these guys like a box of tea or something. That was the currency.
Get your film developed too.
And then I get it back. I'd be able to edit it in the middle of the night using the editing suites. And then I'd get to do dubbing also. So I learned unbeknownst to me at that time when I was my early 20s, I was learning a huge amount just because I was doing it. You know, just get it. And the kids come up to me now and say, how do you become a cameraman, whatever. I just say, well, get out there and do it. You know, find a story. It could be like I'm looking at, a chaise in this room I'm in. And that has a history. So don't pick some big subject. Pick a smaller subject you can elaborate on and then tell the story where that thing's been, what life it's had, the people involved with it, and down the years. So at that time, I was learning so much. And then, of course, having gone to Scotland, I got my hands on cameras. I moved up very quickly there to become a cameraman.
And what was the first project you lensed as a cinematographer?
Well, at that point in Scotland, it's a great learning place because you could do all sorts of films. One day you'd be doing like local news, another time you'd be doing drama or farming even, or the Gaelic language in some faraway island off the west coast of Scotland. One of the first dramas I shot was with Bill Forsyth.
Hmm.
And it was called Andarina. He'd written it. He's a Scottish director who did Gregory's Girl and Local Hero. And so that was my first sort of taste of doing a proper TV film, if you like. And that interspersed with all sorts of other things. So you learned very, very quickly, minimal equipment. And then I went from there back to England, from there to a city called Bristol. I did a whole bunch of work. I was just relentlessly going from one project to another. These were TV films, which a lot of the feature films now we see, and I get all the screeners from the Academy in the US and Academy in the UK, and a lot of these films now are actually, we would have made them. I'm not, I hope this sounds right, but the films, TV films that we made then were actually now the cool feature films. So,
So you were just working a lot out of Bristol.
And there I teamed up with a director called Mick Jackson.
Yes. Was he and that relationship what moved you to Los Angeles?
It did. A nuclear war TV film called Threads with Mick. And that was my first outing with him. He had worked with another cameraman before that. Whatever happened, this person was available or whatever, but someone decided I should do it. So I went up to the north of England, a place called Sheffield, and we shot Threads. And then that won all sorts of accolades. Someone told me recently, actually, because they'd done a special DVD version of this, Spielberg watched it. And,
interesting. It's kind of high concept, right? It assumes that a nuclear holocaust in Sheffield, right? Am I correct? Yeah. That's
well, across the UK, across the world, actually, too, you know.
Right.
And then from there, I did a couple other projects with Mick.
And your relationship with Mick Jackson seems like it grew because you did a couple of projects here. How did LA Story and The Bodyguard come to be?
I left the BBC on freelance. Mick got a film in South Carolina, Columbia, South Carolina, with Dennis Hopper and Gary Oldman and Frances McDormand, actually. And we went off to Columbia, South Carolina, did that. And then whatever year it was, but year later or whatever, Mick called me up and said that Steve Martin had asked him to do LA Story. And would I like to come over there and do that? That was my introduction to LA.
Kind of a funny way to enter the Los Angeles or Hollywood experience, though I guess Chattahoochee, which was 1989, that's the one with Oldman and Hopper. Was that sort of like Yeah, I mean, Dennis Hopper being a huge name, and I mean, Gary Oldman to some degree, but like, was that a big, Ned Beatty is in it, yes. Right? It was kind of a big step into this cultural film landscape for you. Was that the kind of point where you started shooting bigger things here, basically?
It was, although that was a sort of a non-union, you know, semi-indie project. I got no idea what the budget is now, what relatively, and what it was then. Yes, that, so to answer your question, yeah, that was a step into the American way of shooting. First, I got a gaffer from LA, key grip from LA.
How did it change? How was it a change? Was it, or was it a change?
Different ways of working in the States to the UK. And I was used to, like, the grip system here is quite different, the grip gaffer relationship in the States.
How so?
In the UK, in the British system, it has changed a little bit now, but we basically have a dolly grip, and who's a part of the camera department, and then he'll have some people, maybe an assistant or trainee or something, and that's it. The gaffer will do everything from generator cables all the way through to planning, lighting and things, and the flags and colors and the cutters, whereas, as you know.
So you don't really have a grip department.
One of the great things about the States system, which I learned, it took me a little while to learn until I worked with a really great key grip, is how the benefits of it. Because essentially in the States, they would have a truckload of stuff. And here yeah. you might have to sort of plan things ahead with, you know, scaffolding, pipe work and things. You want to have rigs and things wherever there. If you decide in the morning that night you want to have a rig up somewhere, they could probably make it out of wood or do something effective. They have a whole grip team. And the other great thing in the States is you have another pair of eyes watching for you. I've worked some great gaffers here and there, of course, but over there you have another pair of eyes watching for, and you can talk to the gaffer about a particular light and what we're going to do with that, and then the grip will be there also, and they'll start cutting it or anticipating getting stuff ready.
Right, so like your gaffer is more involved here in this system with you crafting light because there's a grip who's actually physically moving things.
To a certain extent. When I explain to the UK, the British people, the way the American system works is... actually, the grips in the States do a lot of the art of it. They will put colors up, they will put cutters up, bounce material, and controlling light and sculpting light. But of course, my background is working with the gaffer very closely. So when I go to the States, my first hiring, if you like, my closest, apart from the first AC and operator, my closest collaborator is the gaffer. So I will work closely with him, and hopefully they will work closely with their key grip, and then right. All the information gets transferred. So it's easier for me to work through one person, the gaffer.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, LA Story was a big project, obviously. And the bodyguard was, I assume, huge. Was it just kind of this natural progression doing these bigger films with these major stars at the time? The two of you having come up together a little bit, what was it like?
It was great. I mean, there's a lot of, obviously with director like Mick and the directors going forward with Lee Daniels, there's a lot of trust and understanding and symbiosis with your like minds and understanding of each other and what you can do, what you can't do. So with Mick, he clearly thought I was his collaborator photographically, and I would understand what he wanted, because Mick came from an editing background, so he'd understand the cuts. And that's where one of the areas I learned to use two cameras all the time, because he'd always want coverage and encouraged me to use certain cameras. So I saw very early on I cut my teeth learning to use cameras, which doesn't worry me at all now.
And do you always do multiple?
I try to, and if it helps the actors and the director get more coverage. If you need to cross shoot for some reason, or they want to overlap dialogue, so therefore you can cross shoot and they get the actors to bounce off each other rather than talking to someone off camera, I think it can be a great benefit. I generally do. Anyway, so as a question about the big film with The Bodyguard, it was a big film for me, but looking back now, I sort of strangely not, well, it's so weird because I look back and I think, how was I not intimidated by this? Is it just because I had nothing to lose? I think partly, and this may be of interest to people listening to this, is the more experience you have and the more knowledge and the people's perception of you that you can do it, therefore the expectations of you are higher. I mean, I've worked over the years with a lot of first-time directors, which is great, I love it, but also I think I get put in these situations when producers and people look at someone like me, they might look at me because I can help a director, writer director a lot more than maybe I did then, because I was with Mick and he was, you know, so I'm trying to say, I don't quite understand how I wasn't, maybe I was, but
I imagine you were ready to meet the moment a little bit, that it was like within the flow of what you had been doing. And despite it being large scale, and I think, is it possible also all of you didn't quite anticipate the elements of phenomena that would come out of that? I mean, the song, Whitney Houston at that time, you know, there were elements that crossed that you can't ever predict when a movie's going to have.
When you're shooting them, you just do not know. And I mean, Precious is a one of many like that for me. But The Bodyguard was very interesting because nobody knew. And of course, Whitney was a huge star at that time. Kevin couldn't do anything wrong. But still, you don't quite know. And that song you refer to, we recorded that live in the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami. And I was on like a 300-mil close-up of her. And even talking about it now, I mean, these are the magic moments when you're doing like lucky enough to do. And talk about that now, and there's tingles around the back of my spine just remembering that, because we did like one take of that song, I think, and all the recordings trucked out the back, and she just did one take.
Did you really? Wow.
So they recorded it live there. And that was the, and we also did some rock, some pre-production, some videos to go with some of the songs, sort of thing. But it was, and also, I'm not sure, I'm a bit wary of how much time you got, but that song, I Will Always Love You, it was going to be a different song on the day we had done a Long Beach somewhere, a little cafe, a diner. They all disappeared off for hours, seemed like hours and hours. And they were gonna use a Jimmy Ruffin song, What Becomes of Broken Hearted. And then they discovered another film was using that song. So they went off big powwow and we came back, and then they used the Dolly Parton song in a juke.
No way. So wait, who's they? Was it Whitney and Mick? And like, who was the team that was like, oh, we can't use the song, we got to find another
probably
one?
Kevin's people, maybe Larry Kasdan, Mick. And we were stuck in this baking hot diner and just blacked out.
Wow, I've never heard that story. That's amazing. I didn't even remember that Lawrence Kasdan wrote it. That's another name on that. That movie has so many, it intersects so many things.
It does, because Kevin and Larry Kasdan go back.
Another question just about shooting Whitney Houston, sort of, you know, capturing her. You mentioned the lens. You were clearly aware as you were shooting it that there was something there, you know, that there was something happening. Like, what is that like?
Well, I tell you what, actually, this is, I think it's my first real experience of seeing someone like Whitney, who you, on the core of a, you know, on a stage, a film stage somewhere, a location, you might just walk past this person sitting in a chair, not even this little person sitting there just going about with reading a magazine or whatever. And then what's extraordinary about someone like Whitney, and I've experienced it since, is this person who becomes, they write this flower, this wonderful creature, becomes this person sitting in this chair in a corner of a room. To the star, you know, they get the microphone, they get the spotlight, and they rise into the moment. This other wonderful, incredible thing happens. And I still wonder to this day what does happen. I think she just was born to the breed. I mean, I directed a gospel documentary about gospel in the States with a British documentary producer, and I was directing this, and then I did it with Whitney's mother. And the history, a little bit of the history of Whitney and gospel singing. So, but it's also part of, because it's so much in her soul. Once she could share that voice with the world, it became her conduit, her way of dealing with her own angst and pain or whatever, which brings us how many years later?
Yes, I was going to say, this obviously ties in. It was one of the first things I thought, knowing that you shot Whitney, thinking about Billie Holiday and thinking about the film. There's so many parallels.
Whitney is a very troubled Soul also, which wasn't really apparent to everyone at that time. And Billy, of course, was. And the voice, this thing, that's her way of, fortunate enough for all of us, but for them as well, I think for the one of the human conditions is we all have our own hang-ups and pains and troubles and things, but the lucky ones, in a way, and I won't say that Whitney or Billy are lucky, the lucky ones,
yeah, but the gift they have.
Find
yeah.
an outlet. And so I think they as I say, it's a slightly common thread through that.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on. It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Developing the relationship you have with Lee Daniels, who's a great director, and you have done a number of really important, powerful films together. I kind of want to figure out or learn when you met and when you formed this dynamic. But I also want to ask about Robert Altman and Gosford Park and you doing that project, working with him. Especially because you mentioned multiple cameras, and then I immediately thought about the way it is, how working with Robert Altman is a departure from other directors, perhaps, and Gosford Park comes a little later in his career. But how did you get involved with
Altman? I think I was approached, and I remember I was driving up. I live in about 4 hours southwest of London, and I remember driving up that morning, and my agent said, "Oh, we got a call from about this film." And I remember sitting in her at my agent's office that afternoon, reading it. And then I think I met the next day, and I, obviously they were seeing other people as well, but there was a sort of a connection there. And I'd always been a fan, and that worked out for me to work with him. And I think actually during the process, how can I describe this? But we spent a little bit of time together before shooting, but not a lot, because one of the ways, I think it's apparent, it's well written, well documented over the years, the way he works. And one of the things I love is what I call the organic approach. And you watch a performance or the actors in a room, then we decide where we as the audience are going to be to observe this. And then let them have the stage, the location, the set, whatever it is. And then we don't come in with any preconceived plans, except that we will be creating intimacy and a freedom for the actors. I think, again, like you said just now, that my lack of concern or lack of fear or whatever of using two cameras was it was just part of what I did and still make it look, hopefully make it look good. Although he wasn't sort of, well, I wasn't desperately concerned the way something looked, as long as it was, he could hear all these people talking, or the multiple soundtracks, and get covered.
Yeah, that's like his real trademark in a lot of ways, right? The way he uses the overlapping dialogue stuff. And
having spent, probably, I don't know how many years before that, maybe 20 years before that, I was like observing his work. And so what am I saying? Oh, and the other thing with Bob, you have to almost light it without him noticing you were lighting it, because he wasn't like anti-lighting or anti-making it look good. But, like if he's tweaking something or doing something, we developed a relationship very early on, and then it's all the dailies and stuff. I remember the very first day we had two cameras, and I was on one camera, and guy called Peter Taylor on the other camera. We're in Maggie's bedroom, I think, or something, and we had two tracks going, because every shot in that movie is a moving shot. There's not one static shot in the whole movie. If you ever see it again,
But you're not allowed to use lights.
For the very first day, I remember one camera moved in front of the other camera, and it's like the guys in the British crew saying, who are a bit conservative then. So, what's going on? It did, because then he did knock, and it didn't spook me. And Bob you're not going to use that bit, you know, for the benefit of having the, you know, so it was a sort of a, the freedom of approach, freedom for the actors. And I think I was in tune with that. And I was sort of enough of a free spirit then to just go with it.
Yeah. Did you and he ever have any, you know, conflict over, I mean, I would imagine you'd need to be a very specific kind of cinematographer or have a loose adjustable approach to be able to adjust to a director who doesn't really want to see you lighting and just wants to let actors decide where they're going to go.
And lack of prep. I mean, he wouldn't want to, we'd go and visit locations and things and discuss other stuff, discuss life, you know.
not lighting, yeah, or rigging. Right.
This is the room we're going to use, and this is how we're going to have Bob Balaban in here. And at that time, it was Jude Law, and that became Ryan Felipe. Those characters that were the rooms we're going to use. So it's just a general approach. In a way, I've done a few films with Andy Tennant, and there's a certain sort of similarity that, in a way, I mean, these people I get on with mostly have a soul. I think Andy Lee. You know, a bunch of other people I work with, of course, but just off the top of my head is that, like, both Bob, actually it's those three, Bob, Andy, and Lee, it's very difficult to go and go scout anywhere and make a plan. And it doesn't spook me, because I know we're getting on the day, we'll work out, choreograph it, and work out what we're doing it, and hopefully it looks half decent. And that wasn't what you were asking me, was it? Oh, Bob, yeah. So we just got on fabulously, and he'd sit with me at breakfast and just talk about what we're doing, or just about life and stuff, you know.
I really want to know how you started working with Lee Daniels. Like, what was the first project?
That year I was in, whatever year it was, I was in Budapest that summer doing a film, and I got a script and an inquiry. My kids had told me off of pronouncing inquiry like that in American.
We don't mind.
And it was going to be later that year. It's very tiny, really interesting script. Anyway, I was not available. So, well, thanks, but no thanks. And later in the year, the film I was going to do fell through. And the inquiry came through again, and I was available. Lee phoned up. We talked on the phone, and I flew out. And we, that was precious. And I had, it was going to be a very short shoot. It's going to be basically Thanksgiving to Christmas, like tiny budget. I had supper with him and his mother and some friends at Thanksgiving that year. And then we shot through to Christmas, the holidays, and then, which we weren't supposed to finish. Anyway, so then it went on the new year, and then we did Ramada the following June, because by then people could see that we had something, potentially something special, and there was a bit more money came in. Anyway, so the way we worked, I think, again, it's that sort of... It's like a marriage, you know, where you have a meeting of minds and a lot of experience in my area. And I have to say this about myself, but I don't have an ego, but of course I do, because I'm a human being. But I might always try and what I do subvert my ego to the story, the director, or the way that they want, because I think I learn more, because I will just... I think all cinematographers are chameleons, or they should aspire to be. With Lee, he could see, I could see what he was trying to get. And together we went somewhere where neither of us had gone before. I think that's also a secret to a perfect relationship in marriage or friendship or anything else. And certainly with cinematographer and director, you both embark on this journey. You're going to go, it's easy to go the same trodden path, but you go somewhere neither of you have been before. You bring your life, your experiences, your knowledge to the table.
I mean, one of the things that's so cool about it, and the way you're talking about it, is that you come from very different places, backgrounds, but also like perspectives, but you melded together on these projects and they become these kind of unique expressions. Precious obviously was like a breakthrough. A lot of these movies, like Oscar nominated and things like that, or winners in some cases. But then, you know, following up, when the two of you, you know, you collaborate again on The Butler, and
the Empire pilot we did too. The pilot for the Empire.
Oh, and the Empire pilot, right? I forgot that that's his. Yeah, like he's had quite an impact like you describe it as this marriage of going new places. Do you feel the two of you evolving what you're doing in each one a little bit?
Oh, definitely. I think you can get deeper into it. It's a trust, which you have to keep. Like any marriage or friendship is an excitement. In my early days, I used to be very purist and say you should never work the same director twice, because what happens in the first film, it's like the first date where it's really exciting and it sort of free something happens. And then you do another film because you're friends, and actually then you don't want to hurt your friend and you don't necessarily speak the truth. The further you get into this relationship, the more honest you can be and tell the truth. And then you can actually say, well, look, I think that what you're talking about is that not I would necessarily say is absolutely crap, and then we should do this. And then you have this sort of little creative discussion.
You strike me as such a, like you say, low ego, but like willing to learn and adjust. How do those moments, like let's just take the dynamic you have with Lee Daniels, for example, those moments where you disagree, how do they manifest in a way that you can have a creative disagreement, find a better path forward, but not be in conflict in a damaging way?
One of the great things about Lee is you'll think you're on a certain trajectory and you'll suddenly go off at the right angle or some tangent. And that is very exciting because you're something you didn't, and he does it with actors as well. You know, one day with Andrew, he'd be doing Billie Holiday, and he suddenly with the microphone, the voice of God thing, he'd say, now be Andra, and you just see her face, and suddenly this other thing was happening to her, and he really, he does it with actors, with people like me, and keep you on your toes and make you think. So what if there's any going back to your question, is if there's any creative disagreement, I think he will understand. I'll understand. I think I do anyway. And that's where I think one of the sort of secrets of the relationship was where he wants to go, what he's trying to do with something. So he has a lot of trust there. So if I say, look, let's try this, can we shoot from here? And can sort of that person, that character being in that over there, can they come here or whatever? And he'll try it out. If it works, doesn't work, then we will just investigate stuff. And there's no sort of animosity or
But you're able to navigate disagreement or different aspects without it being conflict.
And then together you go, I think, director cinematography relationships, and it can happen with directors, producers, directors, actors, is that you both go to some place you hire, like a peak or a mountain or whatever. You go to a place you couldn't scale on your own, but together you're going to go to this place higher than you dreamed you might have gone there, either with anybody else or then you're on your own. You're still going to have on the precipice of getting up to the peak of this mountain, you're going to slip and slide, but then you're going to save each other and support each other to get there. And sometimes it doesn't work. The peak isn't always what you thought it was going to be, but then you've tried it. And I think some of my heroes, cinematographers, are the ones who clearly have tried things out, and you can't always look at their work and think I know their work. It doesn't always work. It's like Altman, a lot of his films didn't work. But when they did, you could see he was doing something different. And Lee is like that, you know.
Have you shot film together on the other projects? Or was this, going back to talking about film, was this the first film?
Precious was film, and The Butler was film.
Okay, so you have a history together. You guys are shooting on 35.
Yeah, I mean, they were both, I mean, I think The Butler was probably at a point where digital was sort of grown up enough. But certainly Precious was far enough back to not even think about using digital, and Butler may have been on the cusp, but we shot film on that too. And of course Empire Pilot was for TV, so we shot digital on that. And then Billy, it was like a no-brainer to go the celluloid route.
Did you get any pushback anywhere on choosing that?
Not at all. And the producers were totally got it, understood. And we had a lab in Montreal, so we could get the film back. Wasn't it? Don't want to send it off to New York or LA or anywhere. And that was great. And we shot a lot of film.
Yeah.
So, a lot of film. A couple of days, we shot nearly 40,000 feet each day.
Wow. So. Tell me about the using the Bolex and stock and just creating the period. I mean, we don't talk about using film as much as I wish we did. I love it as a medium, so I'm always curious to hear about, you know, a feature like this, and I feel like you could probably part of the warm embrace of celluloid to create the feel of the era, which I'm very happy I recognized it.
the warm embrace, I have to remember that one. That's true. The film has a depth, and as much Kodak will deny it, there's a when the light hits the back layer, the celluloid side of the film, as it goes through the emotions and bounces back, there's something else happens. It's a little magic, and the film's always moving. It's things alive in each frame you see. Have you seen the whole film?
Yes.
You have, agree. So it's sort of, it's a live thing happening. It's on digital, and there's some great films and TV shot on digital, of course, now. But there's sort of things moving, each frame is moving. And I think the way it blurs, the way the human eye and brain looks at things, there's a blurring goes on. And I think film has that, whereas digital tried to be very crisp, sharp, and captures each frame in a different way, I think I said earlier. But
you mentioned the Bolex, and I kind of wanted to get a sense of when the Bolex worked its way in and some of the choices, like what stock you chose and why, and how your approach to, you mentioned the lenses too, but just the general strategy, I guess.
Most of the film stock we use, probably about 90% of the film stock we use is 35mm 5.2-5219, which is the 500 ASA tungsten balance stock. Most of Billy's life, she didn't basically get out of bed till 2 p.m. And most of our life was like nighttime. So
you needed a faster stock.
And I think it's just a beautiful stock anyway. And I think once you decide on the brush you're going to use, or the pen or the ink, whatever it is, you stick with that regardless, because I think it can be, what I say is like you look at a Bible and there's zillions of words on each page, or you look at a comic book. That each one's telling a story, and it's a certain style of thing. So whatever your choice is, you stick with that, because you don't want to like disturb the audience and take them out of that style of image making. And then we use 16mm clockwork Bolex H16 for some of the sequences. We tried it electric, but the thing about electric is a very instant stop and start. So it doesn't give you the flash frames. With a clockwork Bolex, I could intermittently press the shutter, and it would give these flash frames, and intermittent motion was like you're creating a stop motion, but staccato image within the actual shooting process. So, and Lee loved that. We loved it. And when Billy was in some of her darker, worst moments, we employed this, and then they liked it so much in the cutting room, they transferred some of the 35mm footage and doctored it to make it look like the 60mm Bolex footage with this sort of staccato flash frames and images like that. And there's a scene in the film where the end of the scene is a replica, as close as we can get it, of a famous iconic image of Billy in a recording studio holding a glass of gin with a microphone. She's completely out of it when she's lost. She's not doing anything. And we shot that at 4 a.m. on a Saturday morning. Everyone's keen to go home after like an 18-hour day, whatever it was. And I said to Lee, can I just get the Bolex out and shoot some more stuff? And so I just did some more things of her hands, her face, and the band. And it's these moments, I think these are moments we live for in making films, that these magic moments, that there's 10 minutes of shooting time, but they're on there forever. You know, I'll be looking over, in 5 years' time, I'll be in an aeroplane somewhere looking over someone's shoulder, and I'll see this film. And I think, that's what we did. And that 4 a.m. that Saturday morning. We have people listening to this. It's like a drug, and it's those magic moments you live for. And when you're doing it, sometimes you think, why am I doing this? It's so bad, hard, you know, you aren't in a freezing cold. And then you stop doing it, you get withdrawal symptoms, and then you go back in.
You want to find those moments.
You're striving for these highs, you know, and they come along. They do come along, but you have to keep working hard at it.
I love that there's a lot of connections between The Bodyguard and Whitney Houston and this, the United States versus Billie Holiday. But one of them also seems to be that those moments happened filming both films for you.
Yes.
Does every film have those moments, or does it for you?
Oh, gosh, I hope so. I mean, some don't.
Yeah.
But I think it's, I'd like to say most of them do. I mean, there's always, when you love doing what you do, when you love doing, and you're lucky enough to do it, that you these moments, you just unwittingly, they
show up
because you work. Well, they do, because you work so hard on it, and it's often the connection between a camera. I would say my camera, but this camera thing, which is capturing some magic moment from an actor, and it's not about the big spectacle or the flying people flying around and being superheroes and things. It's actually these incredibly intimate moments between the and the audience, which is this, we use the camera to do that. The camera is the audience, taking back to the Altman thing, and that connection you get, and that's the magic, you know.
Yeah, well said. I can't say it any better. Well, thank you so much for all the time you gave us. This was really fun.
Thanks everyone for listening. Thanks to Andrew Dunn for coming on. Check out United States versus Billie Holiday. It's available on streaming platforms and it was shot on film, in case you didn't catch that. We mentioned it a few times earlier. Be sure to check out our gear guides. We're really excited to have launched these. All you have to do is go to the NOF Film School homepage, scroll down to the bottom, and in the footer, there's a little thing that says gear guides. Click on that. It'll take you to a page filled with individual guides for all your purchasing research needs, from lenses to drones to software to screenwriting software to cameras, different kinds of cameras, different scale cameras, everything you want. And we're going to keep adding to this and keep updating it. And it's really just a resource for you to research what's out there and what uses various items have at various price points. So bookmark the page. Frequent it often. Let us know what you wish we were covering there. And of course, like, rate, and subscribe to the podcast. Who would you like to hear us interview? What kind of topics would you like to hear us discuss? Let us know. Ask at nofilmschool.com. Thanks so much.